Forum, 6 to 8 p.m., the public forum, the final statewide Cleaner Air Oregon public forum. And you can find all these links to all this stuff on at kboo.fm under Wednesday Talk Radio. Thank all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's it for today. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Full Gallop, produced by Triangle Productions. The play runs through Saturday, October 8th at the Sanctuary at Sandia Plaza in Portland. Full Gallop is a portrait of Diana Vreeland, who stood at the center of American style for 5 decades. As editor of Harper's Bazaar and Vogue magazines and as a member of the International Cafe Society, she chronicled the extraordinary people and events of her time. This play is a portrait of Vreeland at a turning point in her life. Again, that's Full Gallop, now through October 8th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO at the Clinton is our monthly film series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Sex and Broadcasting, will play Thursday, October 13th at 7 p.m. Sex and Broadcasting is a documentary about the revolutionary independent radio station WFMU and its station manager, Ken Friedman. The film explores the question of how to do interesting, cool, culturally significant radio and internet broadcasting while being a sustainable institution.
I just want there to be a WFMU. I want WFMU to exist as a place where people can go who don't fit in, where people can go to find things that have been hidden.
Again, that's Sex and Broadcasting, Thursday, October 13th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage.
This program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring women's clothing, jewelry, accessories, and gifts with a focus on U.S.-made and certified fair trade natural fiber clothing since 1984. Gazelle is located at the corner of Northeast 41st and Fremont and at gazellenaturalfiberclothing.com.
Good morning. It's 9:02. This is KBOO Portland. October 5th, Wednesday, coming up this morning at 9 o'clock in just a minute or so, Political Perspectives, Mark Crispin Miller, media critic and NYU professor, critiques corporate media's recent performance and looks at ongoing developments that threaten freedom of the press. Coming up at 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia. At 10:15, Flashpoints is off today. Instead, we'll hear a program on gender bias and the 2016 election with Sarah Angervine, professor of political science at Whittier College, and Emily Crockett, a journalist with Vox Media. At 11, The Bike Show features Rebecca Hamilton and Scott Cohen talking about Portland State University class on transportation options and making neighborhoods more bicycle-friendly and safe. PSU professor Aaron Golub presents his research on cycling with a broader social justice framework. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support for KBOO Community Radio. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. And now, Political Perspectives on KBOO.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, Our Free Press as a Clear and Present Danger. We are joined for the hour by Professor of Media, Culture, and Communication at New York University, noted author and media critic Mark Crispin Miller. Please stay with us for an hour of discussion about media, censorship, propaganda, and more with Mark Crispin Miller.
An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces slaving for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of just our brothers and our sisters. We won. The people together can overthrow the system.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we're joined by Mark Crispin Miller, and we're going to be talking about our free press as a clear and present danger. And here is Peter to introduce Mark to you. Peter?
Mark Crispin Miller is a professor of media, culture, and communications at New York University and publisher of News from the Underground at markcrispinmiller.com. His books include Boxed In, The Culture of TV, Observations on the National Disorder, Fooled Again, and The Real Case for Election Reform. Mark, welcome.
Thanks, Peter. It's great to be with you guys again.
One of the things you're doing this year is writing the foreword to our 40th anniversary book, Censored 2017, which we're really honored that you're doing that. And you really talk about the transformation of corporate media, certainly over the last 40 years, and even more recently. Could you give us a thumbnail of what you're saying?
Let me say first that I was really honored that you guys asked me to write the foreword to this momentous publication. You know, Project Censored has been doing such righteous and necessary work for so long. I was really pleased to be able to kind of lend my voice as a way to help sell the book and get the issues out there into people's minds. So what I did was, and I took this opportunity to try to make a large and convincing statement about what happened to this nation's so-called free press over the last half century or so. And it is really kind of an alarming situation. One of the reasons, probably the main reason why I jumped at the chance to take this assignment on was that I've had the feeling for a while now that there's something alien about the news that we get day in, day out. There's something unfamiliar to me. Now, I mean, I'm studying the press in this country for decades, really, since around 1980 or so. And I've seen many kind of mind-boggling propaganda drives, lived through many moments when the whole press seemed to be unanimously pushing some big lie or other. I mean, usually this has been in times of war, right? The invasion of Grenada, the invasion of Panama, Desert Storm, you know, big time. And so that in itself is nothing new. I mean, it's really been going on since World War One, on and off. But over the last several years or so, I've really often had this uncanny feeling about the mendacity and the irrationality and the belligerence of our free press. Kind of a breathtaking experience. If I could just digress for a moment historically, it got me thinking again about the experience of American reporters covering Hitler's Germany before the outbreak of World War II. I went back and I looked at William L. Shirer's classic Berlin Diary. You know, he was covering Hitler's Germany for CBS Radio, and he kept a diary with the conscious intention of publishing it after he was eventually thrown out of the country, as he knew he would be, in order to tell the truth. The truth that he couldn't really tell on the air from Berlin because of Goebbels' censors and so on. And at several points in the Berlin Diary, he marvels at how completely misled the German people had been by the unanimous deceptions put across by the German press. And he talked, you know, specifically along those lines about the buildup to the invasion of Poland, for example. When all the German newspapers were screaming about Polish atrocities against Germany, about Polish aggression, and the need for Germany to defend itself against Polish aggression, he was amazed by this because he understood that everybody outside of Germany knew that it was precisely the opposite, that it was exactly the other way around. I returned to that historical antecedent because I think it really does kind of capture the way I've been feeling about the way that the Western press, the U.S. press, covers Russia, for example. The way that the Western press, the U.S. press, covered Robert De Niro's decision to show the documentary Vaxxed, From Cover-Up to Catastrophe, the documentary about the MMR vaccine. What I'm trying to tell you guys is that I took this opportunity to write the foreword as a way to get across that something really, really wrong is going on here, that our press is doing the very opposite of what it was supposed to do, according to the framers and the authors of the First Amendment. It doesn't really serve the people against the state. It doesn't really arm the people with information about what their government is doing, but it seems to be doing the opposite.
Mark Crispin Miller, just using a couple of the examples that you brought up, we're in the midst of a seemingly endless campaign process here in the Republican National Convention, the Democratic National Convention. This is really, in many ways, a triumph of spectacle, and it's pretty amazing, the lack of in-depth kind of reporting that's going on. And the thesis that I'm hearing you outline is you're talking about what we refer to as our free press, and you're saying that it's as if the outliers are the actual intrepid journalists. And systemically, what we have is top-down managed news propaganda, bread and circus kind of worship going on. It's really of epic proportions. And it also sounds like you're saying that in the last 30-odd years that you've been studying this, are you saying that it seems to be worse now?
Yeah, I think it is definitely worse now. The reason why I mentioned my longevity as a media critic was that I don't want to be accused of romanticizing the past as if we ought to look back to some golden age of perfect coverage, because I don't think that's the case at all. And I talk in the foreword about what happened to genuinely independent reporters like George Selden, who as long ago as 1939 was basically driven out of the mainstream press and forced to start his own independent newsletter, which he called In Fact, and which ran from 1940 to 1950. And something very similar happened to I.F. Stone after he wrote The Hidden History of the Korean War. He was a pariah, and he had to start I.F. Stone's newsletter, which ran from the 50s into the 70s. So, you know, I am acutely aware of the fact that really throughout our modern history, the press has been unreliable, to say the least, and has served elite interests as opposed to serving the interests of the people. This has gone on for a very long time. But to answer your question succinctly, yes, it's worse than ever. First of all, because it seems to me that the scale of the falsehood is far greater. I also want to add that it isn't just the corporate press, unfortunately, but much of the left liberal press as well is also guilty. I mean, let's talk about the campaign right now, for example, and the coverage of the campaign, and the fact that it's all about spectacle, and it's all about how Melania Trump plagiarized Michelle Obama's speech, you know, as if that's a terribly important story, or that Ted Cruz didn't actually come across with any kind of an endorsement of Donald Trump. And it's all about Donald Trump and how rude and boorish and racist he is, how he breaks the rules.
Then there was Laura Ingraham's what looked like a Nazi salute at the end of her convention speech. I'm not saying that hyperbolically. I'm saying, you know, the right arm raised business that we have seen at some times. I mean, again, it isn't even hyperbolic at this juncture.
No, it isn't. But let me say some things about this whole Trump business that I think are terribly important. There is no doubt whatsoever that Donald Trump is an abomination and is playing on the very worst in us, or I should say in some of us. I mean, really, his crudeness, his cruelty, his fascist tendencies are off the charts. It's kind of over the top in a way. But the problem that I have with all of this is that, first of all, it has been spun both tacitly and explicitly as a kind of pitch for Hillary Clinton's candidacy. And behind all this and preceding all this has been the complete erasure of Bernie Sanders and his campaign. The press that's going bananas over Trump's horribleness is, first of all, the same press that for a very long time has turned a blind eye to the stark racism that has driven the Republican Party's, not just its campaign tactic, but its election fraud. I mean, for years and years, especially since 2000, the Republican Party, with the collusion of an either spineless or corrupt Democratic establishment, has been systematically disenfranchising American voters based on race primarily and class, has been disenfranchising and ripping off black voters, Hispanic voters, student voters, Native American voters. And it hasn't been any secret that they've been doing this. I mean, they are driven by a racist agenda, okay? All of a sudden, as if the press has just discovered the racism in the Republican Party, and I've even noticed lately in the New York Times all these invidious comparisons of Trump with George W. Bush. Suddenly, George W. Bush is represented as a kind of moderate figure who believed in reaching out. He believed in the Republican Party reaching out to African-American voters. And people like Paul Ryan are very troubled by Trump's overt racism, as if what the Republicans, what they really want is a kind of tacit.
Dog whistling.
Yeah, dog whistling, exactly. So I'm really troubled by the fact that the press has, throughout the last several months, demonized Bernie Sanders or erased Bernie Sanders. The mainstream press has run tons of disinformation about his program and his campaign. They have absolutely blacked out a great deal of iron evidence, I mean really solid evidence, of systematic vote suppression and election fraud that have deprived Bernie Sanders of a nomination that really should rightfully be his. So when we talk about the Trump phenomenon, you know, I think it is important that we note its triviality, the triviality of the coverage, the superficiality of the coverage, the emphasis exclusively on style over substance.
The roughly $2 billion of free coverage?
Yeah, they created this phenomenon, and then they turn around and they deplore it. I've been very concerned for a very long time. Since my own book on the theft of the 2004 election came out and was almost totally blacked out, you know, and attacked and so on, I've been concerned about the press's very pointed uninterest in taking a serious look at the fact that this nation's voting system is the worst in the developed world. I mean, it seems to have been deliberately manipulated not to be a machine for democracy. And just to return to a point I made earlier, it isn't just the corporate press that has tuned out this vastly important issue, but it's the left liberal press as well. In response to the rising concern on social media about the theft of Bernie Sanders' votes, in response to that, you know, flood, much of it excellent work, demonstrating very clearly that Bernie Sanders has been systematically ripped off as the actual winner of many primaries. On the one hand, you have the New York Times running these so-called think pieces to demonstrate that he hasn't been ripped off. Nate Cohen does these pieces about how exit polls are really not reliable. This is all just fantasy. This is false. It's all sophistry. It's all disinformation. The stuff he has to say about exit polls is just demonstrably untrue. And the Times, meanwhile, continues to refer to exit polls in other countries when they have elections. Somehow their exit polls are accurate. Ours are not to be trusted. So you get that from the New York Times. And we got the same thing after the 2004 election. We get the same kind of dismissive response from The Nation. You know, Josh Holland at The Nation did a piece a few weeks ago claiming that all these claims that Bernie Sanders' votes have been stolen are conspiracy theory. We have The Nation actually using the conspiracy theory meme.
Mark Crispin-Miller, let me jump in right there. We have to take a brief break, but when we come back, let's follow up on that with The Nation. And you've brought up conspiracy theory with this issue of the election and election fraud. So let's continue that. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with Professor Mark Crispin-Miller about our free press. We'll be back after this short musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. On today's program, we're joined by Mark Crispin-Miller, author of numerous books on media. He's a professor at New York University. Also, this year, Mark Crispin-Miller is writing the foreword for Censored 2017 and talking about our free press as a clear and present danger to our democratic culture and society. Mark Crispin-Miller, before the break, you were talking about elections and conspiracy issues. And Peter, I think you wanted to jump in here.
Well, I certainly would like to elaborate historically about the 2000-2004 election that Mark's written about. They were both fraudulent. And I have said many times that George W. Bush was never really elected to the presidency. But that's continued. And Mark, you used the term, we have been using the term truth emergency now for over a decade. You mentioned George Orwell's term, the Ministry of Truth. Is corporate media really to that level where they're just lying to us?
That's an interesting question, because you always have to ask yourself to what extent the reporters themselves and their editors are consciously lying, you know, and I don't think it works that way. I think that there are journalists that cynical, and they're, you know, the word journalist has scare quotes around it. But by and large, I think that it's more a matter of careerism, as journalists kind of persuade themselves that what they're getting from their sources in the government is true. In a way, it's impossible for us to tell. But if we're simply going to use the criterion of whether or not what we're getting from our press is at dramatic variance from the truth, right? Whether or not we're getting big lies, whether or not the reporters themselves actually believe them. I think that by that criterion, what we get in the New York Times and on CNN, etc., is clearly comparable to what George Orwell satirizes in 1984. I mean, in the New York Times, for example, I was reading this piece, front page piece, about Putin's response to the big flap over the doping crisis in Russia. It's a piece about how, in his response to this crisis, Putin is following his usual script. I mean, for one thing, it's not really a news piece. It's more of an opinion piece disguised as a news piece. But what struck me about it was its catalog of all the other things that Putin has done. You know, they mention his seizure of Crimea, for example, which comes up repeatedly in connection with his invasion of Ukraine. These are two things that have never happened. If you read the work of honest journalists like Robert Perry at consortiumnews.com, or you read what somebody like Professor Stephen Cohen has to say about what's actually been going on over there, you understand that these are propaganda fantasies that are credible to most of us because we encounter them everywhere we look. You know, it's not just the New York Times. It's not just the New York Times and the Washington Post. I mean, it's everywhere you look, you know, including Human Rights Watch and so on. So you start to doubt your own sanity. You have to take a very hard look at the actual evidence to find out that Crimea, for example, Russia held a referendum to ask the Crimean people if they wanted to go with the new government in Ukraine, or if they wanted to stay affiliated with Russia, and they voted overwhelmingly to stay with Russia. I mean, by lopsided margins, it was like in the 90s. Now, the exit polls actually verified that formal outcome, and then later, the Gallup, about 4 months later, did a follow-up poll. They found the same high levels of a kind of a mass desire to stay with Russia. And then a few months after that, the German pollster GfK went in there and once again found that the people of Crimea, by and large, wanted to stay with Russia against the new regime in Kiev for understandable reasons. You know, they get very good pensions from the Russian government, whereas they're faced with the prospect of austerity measures if they go with Ukraine. The government in Ukraine has a very frighteningly influential component of neo-Nazi parties, which has been reconfirmed vividly by newspapers like The Telegraph in Britain, but which the U.S. press consistently denied, right? I mean, I could go on in this vein. The fact is that what we hear about Russia, what we hear about the moderate opposition in Syria is another example. This is fantasy, you know. This is completely false. Just to veer in a somewhat different direction, I closely followed this controversy, which I mentioned earlier, over the documentary Vaxxed by Andrew Wakefield, when Robert De Niro decided to include it at the Tribeca Film Festival here in New York. The whole press came down on him like a ton of bricks, attacking him for promoting a dangerous documentary. And he caved, pulled the documentary the next day. Well, okay, I saw the film. I actually watched the film. And there was a special screening of it here in New York. And I was staggered to discover that the film itself bears no relation to the description that every media outlet gave us.
Many of the critics of the film didn't watch it. The Houston government was even involved, the city government there, in banning the film.
None of the reporters who wrote about it had seen it. I mean, I got this from the film's producer. None of them had seen it. They all described it as an anti-vaccine documentary, which is completely false. It is not an anti-vaccine documentary. It is about one vaccine in particular, and it is about the fact that the research team that dealt with the MMR vaccine at the CDC, the research team that dealt with that that team consciously and meticulously falsified their own findings in order to conceal the fact that there is significant evidence that that vaccine does tend to cause autism in children under three. And as you say, the source for this is Dr. William Thompson, who was the lead author of the study that was falsified. His audio confessions are the spine of this film, which is 100% accurate. Okay, none of this comes across in any of the attacks on the film. The attacks on the film are all completely false.
Mark Crispin-Miller, let's get back to this meme you had going a little bit before the break when you were talking not just about the corporate media, but you were starting to talk a little bit about the left press and how they fall in line kind of obediently with the establishment. And you were mentioning The Nation and their coverage of the election and of Sanders and so forth. And of course, Peter Phillips here did a study in our 2008 book on the failures of the progressive press to cover controversial or third rail issues like election fraud, problems with 9/11. And of course, now that the 28 pages are out, people that were vicious critics of us for covering things are saying, well, gee, maybe there's more to that. The left press has been very violent and closed-minded about any of the issues surrounding vaccines at all. Even having a conversation or a discussion about it is verboten. Let's go back to that criticism that you were getting into about the progressive press.
Yes, it's been an education for me, I have to say, when it comes to the most important stories of our time. And I that sounds like hyperbole, but I really mean it. When it comes to the most important stories of our time, the left press has been either AWOL or actually quite ferociously on the wrong side. I mean, I think of Rachel Maddow, for example, who's regarded as a kind of progressive icon. Rachel Maddow has gone out of her way to attack the so-called 9/11 truth movement, you know. I mean, pointedly attacked that movement. This kind of thing and The Nation's dismissive, often jeering reference to people who claim that we've actually lived through stolen elections, this kind of thing, I believe, is part of the awful legacy of the Kennedy assassination. I mean, I actually believe that all of this stuff dates from that terrible, pivotal moment in our history. And I've lately been rereading a lot of stuff and reading much stuff for the first time about that moment. And I happened to read Mort Saul's memoir, Heartland, you know, the great political comic Mort Saul, who actually became an investigator for Jim Garrison when Garrison was doing his investigation of the Kennedy assassination back in the 60s. And Saul makes the point, which he's continued to make to this day, that from that moment on, the left press was, for the most part, as silent on that crime and refused as consistently and kind of blindly to look into what had happened there as the mainstream press was. And I believe that the same thing continues to happen, that the fear of being labeled conspiracy theorists has crippled many of our progressive journalists. And I can't help but think, just to put it right out there, that other of our progressive outlets have been more deeply compromised. You know, for example, after the 2004 election, Marcos Melitzis, the founder of Daily Kos, which I guess is probably the most influential progressive website that promotes the interests of the Democratic Party, Marcos Melitzis came out with a statement saying that Daily Kos would no longer allow anyone to post pieces about the theft of that election. I mean, it was a diktat. He basically said, we're not running anything on this question. We're just not going to do it.
Well, we had a similar experience at Institute for Policy Studies regarding 9/11 that we wrote about in our 2011 book. They just said that the topic in general was verboten.
Exactly. And I think it's appropriate in connection with this to note that somebody did out Marcos as someone who had interned with the CIA. Okay. I mean, maybe it's an overstatement to say he is a CIA asset, but I think that that connection is notable. I think we have a responsibility to mention it and to mention his response when he was outed. He said that he did indeed intern there. He said it was actually a very liberal organization. He actually said that. And then in connection with that, people talked about his own background, that he comes from a wealthy coffee-growing family in El Salvador. We have to ask, how did a guy like that come to be in charge of such an influential progressive website, you know? Now, see, these kinds of concerns, I can feel as I speak them that they will sound to many people crazy. They'll sound insane. I'm struck by the fact, just to get back to Donald Trump for a moment, that the New York Times and other, you know, flagship enterprises of the establishment have actually been more exercised about Donald Trump's conspiracy theories than they have about his involvement with the mafia, for example, you know, as a real estate developer in New York. I mean, there are various scandals in connection with Donald Trump that the press has actually not looked into that they should look into. But they spend a great deal of time and energy deploring his advancement of certain notions that the mainstream press considers taboo, right? I mean, the front page of the New York Times has a whole piece about his criticism of NATO. I mean, that's a completely unacceptable position in their eyes. They've also gone on and on about what he has said about vaccines, and they've also gone on and on about what he said about Ted Cruz's father having possibly been involved with the Kennedy assassination. That sounds crazy. And I've been struck by the fact that the press and its attacks on Trump for bringing that up have talked only about the story as reported in the National Enquirer. Okay, the National Enquirer's coverage of that story was, of course, superficial and sensationalist. So to mention only the National Enquirer's coverage, okay, is going to give an impression, an accurate impression, that the story may have been misreported. Nobody's talked about Wayne Madsen's coverage of the story. You know, Wayne Madsen is an investigative reporter who is completely unafraid of the accusation of conspiracy theory. He has his own subscription-only news service, Wayne Madsen Reports. His coverage of the whole issue of Ted Cruz's father having connections, possible connections to the Kennedy assassination, his coverage is quite detailed and pretty convincing, you know? But none of the people who have hooted and jeered at Trump for bringing this up have mentioned Madsen's coverage, because that is one of those issues, like 9/11, like election fraud, like the risks in certain vaccines. These are stories that we are not allowed to discuss. These are stories that journalists are not allowed to investigate.
Well, that's certainly true in the respect that you're talking about. There's certainly topics that are not allowed or unaccepted or certainly not career building inside of corporate media. Right. And then there are people like Trump and or Alex Jones who buffoon these issues and elaborate on them so completely without fact or that it seems ridiculous yet, and they get criticized for that, which is a further way of censoring any coverage on that particular topic.
I agree completely with that. You know, I've often been struck by the fact that patently ludicrous or worse, you know, patently sinister voices are suddenly raised in defense of certain conspiracy theories. You know, so you'll see a lot of stuff, not a lot, but some stuff about 9/11 that comes from virulently anti-Semitic sources, right? And right. you have to ask yourself, whose idea was that, you know? what better way to discredit a whole line of inquiry than to have really offensive types like that?
The allowing now of some discussion about Saudis and the release of the 28 pages, which clearly shows that some Saudis inside their government, affiliated with their embassy, were in support of the alleged hijackers, or some of those folks. But it still reinforces the entire 9/11 Commission report in that there was this, you know, terrorist conspiracy, Osama bin Laden was involved, and these 19 hijackers, no evidence whatsoever that any of them were on any of the airplanes. You know, continues on as a mythology.
That's exactly right. I've had my trouble with that issue of the 28 pages for the very reason you mentioned, that it, good, you know, whatever information they have, we should all know what it is, but it does reinforce the official story. This has been on my mind the last couple of days. Everybody is always very quick to attack the Republicans and the right in general for their benighted views of science. You know, how many times have you heard about the Republican war on science? And the book by that title is a very good book. You know, they talk about creationism and so on. Well, I have a fundamental problem with that whole argument, which is, always comes from liberals and Democrats.
Mark Crispin Miller, hold one moment. This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're having a conversation with professor and media scholar Mark Crispin Miller on today's program. Mark, before the break, you were just starting to talk about how people are very quick in media to get on the so-called Republican war on science. Can you continue where you were going with that?
Absolutely. It's extremely easy to rail the right for its factually challenged claims about the history of the human species, you know, that there are actually people who believe the universe is 6,000 years old. There are actually people who believe that the United States was founded as a Christian republic. I mean, these are ridiculous ideas, and it's more than concerning that people are actually getting them into textbooks, right? But, you know, implicitly, that critique, well, it's too self-congratulatory for my tastes, because the same people who deplore the prevalence of those myths on the right don't say anything at all about their own willingness to accept equally ludicrous notions that are promoted on a regular basis by the establishment media. For example, that a single bullet wreaked all that havoc on the bodies of both John Kennedy and Governor Connolly.
You mean the magic bullet.
The magic bullet theory, that only three shots were fired that day in Dallas in 1963. One of them missed, one of them hit Kennedy in the head, and the other one passed through Kennedy's body and Connolly's body. This is part of the elaborate mythology that was used to argue for a single gunman having, you know, committed the crime. That is a patently ridiculous, a physically impossible scenario, and yet people accept it. Same is the case with the collapse of the Twin Towers, especially Building 7. These are patently ludicrous, physically impossible scenarios that our press has wholeheartedly accepted, that, you know, President Obama will validate at any given opportunity, and that nobody criticizes as a ridiculous fantasy. I would add the same is the case with the, you know, re-election victory of George W. Bush in 2004. It was an impossible victory for many reasons. We're told that a sudden outpouring of Christian evangelicals in Ohio at the end of Election Day accounts for his victory over John Kerry. There simply weren't enough of them to have done that, and nobody saw them. You know? What I'm saying is that it's very, very easy to scapegoat these Christianist primitives for their delusions, right, for their departures.
Or their arc in Kentucky.
Yeah, exactly. We can all make fun of that kind of thing. But, you know, what about the ludicrous notions, you know, on which the whole contemporary liberal consensus is based, you know? That's what I want to know.
Well, Mark Crispin Miller, professor of media, culture, and communications at New York University, you're certainly in on this. And post 9/11, one of the biggest things that has emerged from that, of course, is the war on terror. And if we think about the shootings in Orlando, the bombings and the shootings in Nice and in Paris, and even the police shootings in Dallas and Baton Rouge, these are all labeled as terrorist or lone wolf actions. And we don't really know that. I mean, this is the media's explanation that terrorism, this global terrorism, is doing all of this. But the context of Gladio and other false flag operations historically, what do we really know about these?
Well, no, you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, yeah, there's something I read in the Times. I put this in my foreword to your book. It was a piece, a front page piece about the echoes in Dallas. Okay, it was about the shootings of those cops in Dallas. And it purported to be a piece about how this horrible tragedy recalls the horrible tragedy in Dallas in 1963. And there's actually a passage that says, in 1963, a lone gunman killed the president. This time, again, it was a lone gunman.
I remember seeing that, yeah.
Yeah, it was one of those head-exploding moments. I mean, nobody believes any longer that a lone gunman killed JFK. I mean, maybe a few people believe
it. Even Congress said that there was a conspiracy.
Right. In 1979, even the House Select Committee on Assassination came up with this lukewarm admission that there was a second gunman. I mean, they said it was the mafia. But nevertheless, even they, back then, that long ago, exploded the notion that a lone gunman, Lee Harvey Oswald, did this deed. And then there has been tons and tons of meticulous, unassailable research completely devastating this ridiculous notion that Lee Harvey Oswald was the gunman that day. And yet the New York Times makes that claim. And why? As you say, they make that claim to bolster a claim that a lone gunman was responsible for this crime. And it's just one of many, the sudden recent epidemic of grotesque attacks, terrorist attacks, carried out by these mysterious individuals. I mean, where do they all come from, right? If indeed what happened in 1963, officially what happened, is a complete fantasy, then I think we're probably on solid ground to raise some rational questions about this recent rash of similar crimes, as you say.
That's what the free press ought to be doing, is asking these kinds of questions and following them up. But, you know, these have been happening in succession and with such frequency this past year or so, a couple years, they seem to get sent down the memory hole. Many people have already forgotten about San Bernardino and some of these other issues. And, you know, Peter brought up Gladio, Operation Gladio. And I know one of the things that one of the many things you do is you have a series called The Forbidden Bookshelf. And I know you've been on this program talking about it before. But these historical issues that get thrown down the memory hole, these are things that you focus on in that series.
Oh, our purpose there is to make important works now out of print available again. Unfortunately, we can only do it as e-books, but we bring them out again with new introductions, and these are books that deal with a broad range of the kinds of subjects you're referring to, the things that we need to remember, we need to know. Because if we live in a state of collective amnesia, either we don't know anything about the past or we've forgotten it all, we are supremely vulnerable to any kind of manipulation by the state. We are incapable of functioning as the citizens of democracy if we don't know the past. Along these lines, I want to plug a book that we did not publish or republish, but it is about Operation Gladio. It came out in 2015. It was almost universally ignored despite or because of its excellence as a work of sort of journalistic scholarship. It's called Operation Gladio by Paul Williams, who used to be a neocon and a consultant to the FBI, a frequent guest on Fox News, because he would talk about the threat of Islamic terrorism until he began to notice that there is actually significant evidence that much Islamic terrorism is actually funded and cultivated by the American government. He actually discovered a place called Islamburg in upstate New York where they were training radical converts to Islam. You know, these are guys who converted to Islam in prison in this country and were being trained as crack troops, terrorist troops, under the auspices of our government. He did a piece about this for some outlet, and this led him to research the whole phenomenon, the whole story of Operation Gladio, and the strategy of tension, and the deliberate creation of terrorist incidents as a way to discredit the left.
These are false flags.
These are all false flags. Operation Gladio is one of these life-changing books. I can't recommend it strongly enough. And it's telling, it seems to me, at the very least, that he is not somebody to whom the press is turning now that we're hearing about all these terrorist attacks, and for good reason, because he would give us perspective on them that would cause us to be just a little bit more skeptical about official claims as to who these guys are and where they come from, you know? But it's something your listeners should know about. It's a book they should know.
Mark, I wanted to ask a little bit. One of the research issues that we have in the Censored 2017 year book this year has to do with public relation firms, what we call public relations and propaganda firms. The three largest are Omnicom, WPP, and Interpublic Group, which employ 215,000 people, have $35 billion in revenue, and operate in conjunction with Homeland Security, the CIA, the military, and of course, promoting products for sale worldwide. But they're massive, and they are now involved in deliberate propaganda to the point that corporate media is receiving two-thirds to 80% of their stories either from PR firms or press releases from government. So it's not like they're out there doing investigative reporting in any fashion. There's some of that going on, but for the most part, they're being fed. And so that's certainly one thing that we've looked at deliberately here at Project Censored.
That's very important to look at that, because this represents a kind of an extreme version of things that have been going on for quite a long time. As the press has become increasingly streamlined as a commercial operation, and as it has become ever less diverse, more tightly controlled by what amounts to a kind of media cartel, reporters have less and less money for real investigative projects. They're stretched ever thinner. They're required to do more and more. And this makes them, you know, ever likelier to run with stories that are basically written for them. Now, again, this has been going on for a long time, but it's reached a kind of a critical moment at which, since 9/11, we now have, as you say, this sort of triad of gigantic propaganda firms with one foot in the world of commercial propaganda and the other foot in the world of political propaganda, you know, working officially to generate content for mass reception as journalism, right? So it shouldn't really come as any surprise, I guess, that what we often get, it bears no real relation to empirical reality.
The Ministry of Information has been privatized.
Yeah, exactly. It's been privatized. You know, under Dr. Goebbels, it was the Nazi government that called all the shots. Well, it's not like that. It's a little different. It's more fun than his propaganda was. But I don't think it's any more honest.
We're speaking with Mark Crispin Miller, professor at NYU. We're talking about our purportedly free press and media propaganda issues and censorship today on the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with Mark Crispin Miller for the hour today. He is a media scholar at New York University, author of numerous books on media issues, and also penned the foreword for Censored 2017 this year. Mark Crispin Miller, just before the break, talking about propaganda, and I know that oft we'll hear cries from critics saying that, well, you can't compare anything to the Nazis, et cetera, et cetera. But we're talking about power structures here. We're talking about dynamics of control here. We're talking about much broader issues than one specific historical period. And you were also talking a little bit about the PR issues and sort of outsourcing of that from government. And Peter had brought up PR. And recently, you sat down with journalist and certainly friend of Project Censored, Abby Martin, on the Empire Files, and you all did a fantastic program on Eddie Bernays and the rise of public relations. That's really what we have here nearly 100 years later now in the United States. That's basically the full-blown system.
Well, it is, except, you know, I guess, since we're wrapping it up now, it's appropriate to look at the bright side of the picture, you know, because anyone tuning in and listening to us is going to get a very dark impression of what's going on, and rightly so, because this is a truth emergency we're living through. These are dire times when the entire media system, the entire commercial media system at any rate, is giving us disinformation that will have catastrophic consequences for us all. But what I think promising at this moment is the fact that we have now more than ever before the means right at our fingertips to get the other side of the story. This is a point I end my foreword with because it's actually very encouraging. You know, whereas, like, you know, 50 years ago, if you didn't believe the Kennedy assassination story as officially released and unanimously promoted by the press, you really had to put on your walking shoes and withdraw some money from your bank account and take a trip somewhere. I mean, you'd have to visit specific archives of assassination-related material. You'd have to go seek out witnesses of the assassination. You'd have to go visit Jim Garrison in New Orleans. You'd have to talk to people. You know, you'd have to get out there. Today, you don't have to go to all that trouble. Today, you can simply go online, and you can find, you know, if you're diligent, and you go past the first four or five pages of your Google searches, you can start to find other material that puts the official claims in question. I found this to be the case with my own students, okay? I'm teaching at NYU. Most of them don't have a political bone in their bodies. They're not radicals by any stretch of the imagination. But they are all far more open to questioning these official narratives than my students have been in the past. They are very receptive to other ways of looking at 9/11, other ways of looking at our elections and so on, even other ways of looking at these terrorist attacks and so on. They are extremely receptive to hearing the other side of the story about the MMR vaccine. They are not intimidated by the conspiracy theory meme. And I think this represents a significant kind of cognitive and psychological shift that's extremely promising and actually fulfills the promise of the First Amendment in a way, you know?
Mark, this isn't just at NYU. I mean, I'm seeing exactly the same thing at Sonoma State University and other campuses I've talked at. Students are open to this. And 3 years ago, I started a course called Sociology of Conspiracies, and it is packed, and very, very rightfully so.
With one of the books that another series that you do, fantastic work on conspiracy theory in America by Lance DeHaven Smith.
Yeah, that's right. A must read that I included in the series Discovering America, the University of Texas Press. This is the book where Lance explains exactly how and why that meme, that crippling, that incapacitating meme, conspiracy theory, how and why it entered American journalistic discourse when it did, starting in 1967, as a direct result of a deliberate CIA campaign to discredit the authors of books criticizing the Warren Report. And there's no question about this. The memo, the declassified memo laying out this whole campaign is an appendix in his book. People need to know this. But it is profoundly encouraging that this is going on. At the same time, that I believe it is the reason why the attacks on conspiracy theory and on conspiracy theorists are now more virulent, strident, and even hysterical than ever. That you have the president of France actually pushing legislation to make conspiracy theory illegal. You have David Cameron, the former British prime minister, claiming publicly that conspiracy theory is as dangerous as ISIS.
Mark Crispin Miller, in the United States under Obama, we had Cass Sunstein's cognitive infiltration.
Right. An idea to use trolls to disrupt civilized debate about 9/11 online. And the Clinton campaign is also using trolls. I noticed that the Times did a big piece about some poor woman, a journalist in Finland, who was attacked by Russian trolls, you know, because she was critical of Russian foreign policy. Okay, that's deplorable. But I don't notice that the Times has talked about Cass Sunstein's plan. I don't notice that the Times has reported anything about the Clinton team's similar plan. You know, it's just more of the same kind of Ministry of Truth.
And these are Ivy League scholars promoting this kind of censorship.
Except the best and the brightest.
Yeah, that's quite disturbing. And it, again, it's just another example, however, of how the establishment, the plutocratic power elites and so forth, you know, they really do try to dress up, whether it's government or the benevolent free market or our higher educational institutions. They certainly dress them up in one regard, that they are doing things that we learn about or attribute to them. Yet, like you've been saying most of the hour here, and like we've been saying at Project Censored for nearly 40 years, if you actually have a free press and actually have intrepid journalists going to the dark places to shine lights, we find out that these are illusions in many ways.
Exactly. We find it out. I want to return to a point that Peter made about how critics will immediately cry foul when you invoke the Nazis as a kind of antecedent to what we have today. I mean, clearly, the Nazis dealt with journalists far more brutally than our system deals with them. Or Sophie Scholl and her brother, you know, were beheaded for handing out pamphlets critical of the Nazis. That was the White Rose movement. And there were actual reporters who were sent to Dachau for their reporting. All right, that kind of thing doesn't happen, although I want to say parenthetically that we have had many journalists who've died mysteriously, from Dorothy Kilgallen back in the 60s up through Michael Hastings and so on. So that kind of thing is no means unheard of here, because there's quite a long list of journalists who've perished under suspicious circumstances. But by and large, the way our system deals with journalists is to threaten them with a kind of professional excommunication through the use of conspiracy theory as a stigma, you know?
Chilling effects and self-censorship.
Exactly. So any journalist who wants to keep his job and make those mortgage payments and keep his kid in private school is just going to instinctively shy away from talking about the issues that we're talking about today. And American democracy is all the poorer for it.
Again, fairly unfortunate series of developments, but it is also a very systemic one. We remember, if we do go back in history, and I teach history, so I'm kind of friendly with it, the bombing of Al Jazeera offices.
Right, exactly.
I mean, specific targeting of journalists, and really specifically targeting. And of course, what we see here, remember the history of Gary Webb, somebody that really blew wide open the CIA and crack cocaine explosion, and his career was destroyed over it and ultimately ended his life.
Well, yeah, and who were his main tormentors? The New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Los Angeles Times. And let me add that the excellent movie, Kill the Messenger, that Michael Cuesta made about that whole story. I don't know if you've seen it. I mean, it's a terrific, terrific film.
I have. It's wonderful.
And actually, the screenwriter there, Nick Shue, has a new book out on Skyhorse with David Talbot on CIA and media.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. Well, let me note
Hot
to
books
you.
It is. Hot books.
Okay. Let me note to you that I had Michael Cuesta come to a course I teach at NYU, and he talked about Kill the Messenger and told us the whole story of how the movie was not marketed, that it played in theaters for a very short time. He was deeply disappointed in the way that it was handled. It's directly comparable to what happened to Polanski's film, The Ghostwriter, which is another really first-rate treatment of CIA manipulation and so on. You know, unlike Argo, right?
Right.
These movies...
Or Zero Dark Thirty.
Zero Dark Thirty. These movies play all over the place. They get glowing reviews.
The Interview.
They get Oscar nominations. They get Oscars. These far more intelligent and honest films on the same subject get short shrift. Now, you know, nobody's putting a gun to these filmmakers' heads and blowing their brains out. That's true, as would happen in a far more brutal system, or a more overtly brutal system. But nevertheless, you know, there is more than one way to skin a cat. Whatever it takes to make sure people don't know what's going on.
Well, and the CIA is actually helping script some of these films.
No kidding. Right.
Yeah, I mean that literally. I don't even, again, another thing I'm not saying hyperbolically.
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, and the Department of so-called Defense, you know, the Pentagon also helps filmmakers with projects that they approve of, you know, which is actually a violation of the First Amendment, but it is routine. It's the way they function. They will not help you if they don't like the script. But if they do like the script, they'll give you all kinds of military hardware and expert advice and so on.
Well, Mark Crispin Miller, let's end on a high note. Your foreword to Censored 2017 really goes down a lot into the memory hole and makes a real case that our free press has failed in regard of the notion of keeping the public informed. But on the other note, it hasn't failed given that it seems to be designed as a propaganda arm of the state and multinational corporations as a means of controlling public discourse and action.
And in a way, it's important to add, in a way that really puts us all at risk, serious risk, risk of war, risk of some kind of fascism, overt or implicit, puts us at risk in terms of our health, our children's health. You know, to engage in vehement disinformation about something as important as vaccines, that's like a crime against humanity. That's not just a peccadillo. That's not just a failing. That's evil. So thank God for the Internet. Thank God for young people who are immersed in it, and not just in a way get distracted by pornography and Snapchat and stuff like that, but as a source of really crucial information that the press is not giving us.
Well, Mark Crispin Miller, we thank you so much for taking time with us today on the Project Censored Show. Mark Crispin Miller is professor of media, culture, and communication at New York University. He's publisher of News from Underground, markcrispinmiller.com. His books include Boxed In, The Culture of TV, The Bush Dyslexicon, Observations on a National Disorder, and Fooled Again, The Real Case for Election Reform. He's also the editor of Forbidden Books Shelf series for Open Road Integrated Media. Mark Crispin Miller, again, we thank you, and thank you for writing this excellent foreword for Censored 2017 that will be out this fall.
Well, thanks for asking me, and thanks for all the work you
guys
do.
Thanks a lot, Mark.
Bye-bye.
It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
We've just spent the hour with noted media scholar and critic Mark Crispin Miller. Among many published works, Mark Crispin Miller recently contributed the foreword to the forthcoming book Censored 2017 by myself, Andy Lee Roth, and Project Censored. It'll be out this fall. Also, our 40th anniversary summit at Sonoma State University will be this fall. For more details, go to projectcensored.org. You've been tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio, and I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. The Project Censored Show airs on 35 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook.
Special thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer, and our engineer, Erica Bridgman. We'll see you next time.
KBOO Portland, good morning. It's 9:58.
Hello, KBOO members. Thank you for being part of our amazing community. It takes all of us to manage this great community resource, and the role played by the KBOO Board of Directors is essential. Please consider applying to become a KBOO board member if you want to help serve our community and put your gifts and talents to good use. There is a time commitment of about 15 hours a month for all board members, and you must be a current KBOO member. To apply, go to kboo.fm/2016 Board of Directors or stop by the station and pick up a paper copy. The deadline to apply is October 15th. We are looking for folks who love KBOO, who are committed to our community, and want to carry forward KBOO's values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change. KBOO needs you. Apply today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Real Cool Film Series at the Clinton Street Theater. The film this month, Space is the Place, showing Thursday, October 20th at 7 p.m. Space is the Place is an Afrofuturist science fiction classic film released in 1974. Sun Ra, space age prophet, philosopher and Afro-jazz bandleader, lands his spaceship in Oakland, expanding the cosmic consciousness of African Americans. Again, that's Space is the Place, Thursday, October 20th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of your homepage under Community Events. Thank you.